Accession number 10657, reel 29.
I think you were saying that you did some aircraft recognition work at port side.
Yes, that's right. We did a lot of practice in aircraft recognitions. The various planes circled slowly overhead, and we were able to identify quite a lot of the type of air. Well, everything that was going to be used on the invasion was there for us to see, you know, from fighter bombers to Dakotas and all sorts of various aircraft. And we thought that was pretty good. And another example, I think, of the care that was taken by General Montgomery with training, and how this was coming down to his divisional commanders and his brigade commanders. And everybody was thinking on the same lines. We've got to train everybody to a high standard, and we have got to minimize the losses as much as we possibly can. And I think right at the top, this was Montgomery's thinking, dating right back to the First World War. Here again, you see at port side, before we sailed, General Kirkman came aboard and talked to the troops. And he also visited all the other ships that were carrying, that were starting off from port side. So he visited the ships of 50 Dip and 5 Dip. On the 5th of July, we sailed with the rest of the Suez-based D-Day convoy. And the ships set their course westwards through the Mediterranean. I must admit that we all expected the convoy to be bombed. We just couldn't imagine that a convoy, even of our size, before it was joined by the Malta convoys and the UK convoys, could go any distance at all without being spotted. And in fact, on July the 6th, there was an enemy reconnaissance plane reported at about 40,000 feet. But nothing came of that. That was the day after we'd left. There were a few air raid warnings during the voyage, but we didn't see any hostile aircraft, and no bombs were dropped, not actually until we arrived off the beaches.
Did you see any friendly aircraft giving you air cover?
No, I can't recollect that we did, no. On the 6th of July, a motor transport ship in the MT convoy, it was one of the 5 Div ships, was actually torpedoed. But I don't think we knew about that at the time.
You didn't have any submarine alerts then, or anything like that?
We might have done, that's the point. But I can't remember that. It could have been a long way away. If it had been amongst the 50 Div ships, it might have been a bit closer to where we were.
Did you see, well, I mean, could you see a vast mass of ships sailing all round?
Oh yes, you could. But it was very much more noticeable when the other convoys joined us from Malta and the UK. And then it was an absolutely extraordinary sight. I've got that in this next piece, actually. But it was unbelievable. I mean, when I tell you that there were... I did have the figures, actually. I think there were 750 altogether naval craft. 750. And 400 landing craft. You know, quite apart from the troopers and the MT ships and the oil tankers and all that sort of thing. So it was a pretty big thing. Bigger, I would say, than the North African landings of the First Army. Definitely bigger than that. So, we're coming in now to more or less the the plan. And planning had started in April for the Sicily invasion, which was known as Husky. It started more or less about the time we were leaving on Fidaville to return to the Delta. There were two task forces involved, American and British. And the idea which was eventually agreed, was to land in the southeast corner of the island. Prior to the assault, the Allied Air Force, British, Canadians and Americans, had the job of dealing with the ships, any enemy shipping, aircraft and ports. Now, the initial objective of the seaborne attack was the capture of the port Syracuse, which was in the 8th Army sector. This was the most important of the objectives. This would be preceded by an airborne operation. After that, the idea was to develop the operations to capture the whole island. And a high priority was given to Augusta, Catania, and the vital airfields on the Catania Plain, all of them in the 8th Army sector. That was all to do with the 8th Army. Now, the Western Task Force, which was General Patton's 7th Army, would land in the Gulf of Gela, which is the southern coast of Sicily, and below the 8th Army areas. General Montgomery's plan was for two corps to do the job. The 13th Corps, which was us, would land in the Gulf of Noto, south of the port of Syracuse, and this would be 5 and 50 divs. And prior to the seaborne landing, the British Airborne Force in gliders had the job of capturing the Ponte Grande Bridge near Syracuse. So much for 13 Corps. 30 Corps consisted of 51 Highland Div, 231 Brigade from Malta, who incidentally had been under siege on Malta for 3 years, the Canadian Division from the UK, which even more surprisingly had never been out of England, apart from the Dieppe business, and I don't think this involved that division, since 1939. So there are two very unblooded formations, if you like, in the 30 Corps plan. Anyway, 30 Corps had the job of landing south of 13 Corps, take over areas captured by 13 Corps, and link with the American 7th Army. So you will see from that the most important job was being given to 13th Corps. The opposition that we knew of, that was known at that particular time, was two German armed divisions, 5 Italian divisions, and six Italian divisions for coastal defence. But, as you will see later, it was the strategically placed German divisions inland which were the major threat. Now, on the afternoon of the second day at sea, we had a briefing for the officers of the 8th Battalion, which took the whole afternoon. There was a scale model of where the battalion was supposed to land, and we knew now that it was Sicily. On this scale model, there were buildings, roads, tracks, suspected enemy positions marked, and also we had the latest intelligence and aerial summaries, pictures taken by the Royal Navy submarine recce parties, who had a pretty awful job but did it extremely well, and I believe had very heavy casualties, measuring things like measuring the beach inclines, plotting underwater hazards, and all that sort of thing. Also, there were pictures taken by the RAF of the area that we were landing at, and it was, without a doubt, the most thorough briefing that had ever been given to the 8th Battalion officers in the whole war. The 50 div landing was to be in the neighbourhood of a place called Avola. It was a town, I think, of about 22,000 inhabitants, and that was on the left of the 13 Corps front. And the assault on the beaches was to be by the DLI Brigade, two battalions of the DLI Brigade, actually, with our battalion in reserve. The job of the DLI Brigade was to capture a covering position on the high ground overlooking the beaches, some little distance inland from the beaches and then up. 69th Brigade landing later would take over this covering position. Now, the Durham assault on the beaches was by the 6th and 9th Battalions. They had to establish a beachhead to protect the beaches from small arms fire for subsequent landings. Then the 8th Battalion was to land and was to occupy this covering position northwest and southwest of the town of Evola to deny enemy observation from the high ground onto the beach area. So if everything had worked properly by the time we'd got up there, we'd pretty well were keeping people away from the beaches.
What was the ground like inland on the beach?
Well, I'm coming to that one in a few minutes, actually. If I could just run quickly through who we had under command first. We had Detachment of 505 Field Company, one light section of 149 Field Ambulance, two machine gun platoons of the Cheshires. In support, we had the 98th Field Regiment, not our old pals, the 74th, but the 98th, who'd got these 105mm guns on tank chassis, and 107 anti-tank battery. Now, the task was for A Company, the task for the 8th Battalion was for A Company, which was Chris Beattie's company, and my company, which was B Company, to capture the covering position on the high ground northwest of Evola. C Company, which was Harry Walmsley, and D Company, which was Peter Lucas, were to capture the high ground east of Noto, commanding the road approaches to Evola. And the colonel stressed the vital importance, however hard the climb, for the infantry companies to gain the high ground before the enemy mobile reserve could get there. Now, so far as the terrain was concerned, the coastline had soft sand cliffs about 20 to 25 feet high. So they did present an obstacle to wheeled vehicles or carriers. There were rocks in the sea, a certain number of rocks in the sea. Evola itself was about 1,000 yards inland. Now, 1.5 miles north was the only beach for vehicles. Its code name was Jig Green, and it was beach number 47. The water offshore was deep. It was a hard sand beach, but there weren't any exits, and it would be necessary for bulldozers to punch a hole through the sandbank bordering the beach. Funnily enough, years afterwards, when I went back to Sicily to do an exercise with the Malta people, I went down onto one of the beaches and the hole that had been punched through by the bulldozer was still there. Quite a wide one and large enough for vehicles to go through. Now, the left-hand limit of the 8th Battalion operation were two concrete pillars and a circular concrete platform in the sea known as the Lido d'Evola, which in fact was a very good landmark, an excellent landmark, or should have been, when the landing craft were approaching. Now, the enemy defences, there were pillboxes and entrenched localities along the coast about 50 yards apart. Likely exits from the beaches had been wired, but there were very few mines. But this we didn't know at the time, and this fact was not made known to us.
So you're
afterwards.
Going in expecting mines then?
We were expecting that there would be mines, yes.
Were there mines marked on this model?
No, because I don't think that it would have been possible for any of the submarine recce parties to have stayed long enough or gone deep enough onto the beach to check that out. But there was nothing from them to say that there were or were not mines. I think they spent a bit more time charting the offshore obstacles and assessing the the climb, the incline of the beach, more or less from the sea.
The sandy cliff you mentioned, was that higher or lower than the one you'd had to scale?
Much lower. We're on at Suez were the height of this house. They were pretty high. The escarpment at Suez that we had to go up before breakfast every morning was certainly as high as these flats are.
And you'd been going up that in full kit, had you? Battle kit?
Can't remember. We'd have been pretty well. We probably wouldn't have had our Nortec packs on, but we'd have had, we'd have had our webbing equipment, water bottles, and that sort of thing. I doubt whether we'd have had the Nortec, probably the small pack on the back, something like that. Finish this little bit about the enemy defences, if you like. So what was known about the enemy defences? I say we didn't know for sure about the mines. Now, once ashore, the coastal plain was intensely cultivated with vineyards, olive groves, citrus orchards. Stone walls bordered every field and road. 3,000 yards from the coast, the hills rose steeply. They were rocky or covered with grass or low scrub, and the summit was about 1,000 feet above sea level. What we didn't know, and what hadn't been made clear with any of the briefings, because I don't think it had actually been spotted on the photographs, was that the hill we had to climb was intersected by these brick walls. So you were going up a series of terraces, and they were pretty close together, maybe 20 or 30 yards apart. No sooner had you climbed one wall, which was quite high, and dropped over the other side, off you went again, and then you had another one. And it was a very considerable obstacle to be overcome by a complete battalion climbing up there. It hadn't shown up on any of the photographs we saw, which was a great pity, because we might have tackled the thing rather differently. But as it were, we went up there with our full kit and equipment, and the signallers carrying 18 sets on their backs were absolutely all in. It was a hell of a job. We had to help them over by putting our hands underneath the 18 set packs on their backs as they went over and sort of lifting the pack over with them. They couldn't have done it without. The information we knew about the divisional area where we were going to land was that there were no actual coast defences or coast... Sorry, there were no actual coastal guns on or near the beaches. But just outside the area, there was our Italian artillery, which was in a coast defence role. So we were not having to cope with any guns actually on or near the beaches. I think we can do this bit. Petrol was rationed, and of course there were, so we couldn't really have any fires for cooking. Water was a half a gallon a day for all purposes, bearing in mind that we had a gallon a day at Alamein and a half a gallon a day at Gazala. We were right back to very little water for all purposes, and it was laid down that under no circumstances were troops to drink from any wells they might come across.
Do you know why that was?
In case the water not necessarily been poisoned, that might have been at the back of somebody's mind, but it might have been polluted water anyway. But I think possibly people were a little bit concerned about the fact that they might poison the water in the wells. We weren't given that as a reason. We were just told that under no circumstances were we to drink from them. The passwords we had to learn, the challenge was desert rats. The answer was kill Italians. We had to know what action to take with civilian personnel. We had to not damage their property. We had to know which installations had to be kept intact. There were do's and don'ts about entering a village or town. The mayor had to be impounded, and the chief of police had to be impounded. Wine distilleries had to be guarded. And then, of course, there was this little booklet, The Soldier's Guide to Sicily. It was really about the island, its history and its people. But there was one particular sentence in there which amused everybody and was also a fairly graphic warning. And this sentence read, "The Sicilian is still, however, very well known for his extreme jealousy insofar as his womenfolk are concerned, and in a crisis still resorts to the dagger." This appeared in The Soldier's Guide to Sicily. Anyway, there we were. We had so much to learn still in so little time, but the full morale was certainly high. And to close on that one, as part of the admin, we had 48-hour mess tin rations, which were for D-Day and D+1. No other food was available, or would be available, and the few vehicles that landed on D-Day also had rations for 2 days. But one day of the rations on the vehicles had to be kept in reserve for airborne or commandos. Right, that's the finish of that bit.
You're mentioning that you've got some people from 505 Field Company with you.
Yes.
What were they supposed to be doing? Were they mine clearing?
Well, they would have been. we might have had them with us to make gaps through wire or the minefield if necessary, or for mines. It would have been one of those two things. The sort of engineers that looked after the the beach at a later stage was a thing called the beach brick, which wasn't ashore at that time. So those engineers with us would have just been to use for mine lifting or wire breaching or whatever.
And then you mentioned this field battery, which was guns mounted on
priests.
Chassis.
Yes.
Priests.
Yes.
How did they perform? Were they a great improvement over the towed guns, do you think?
Well, but I didn't actually see them performing until until we got to Primosoli Bridge. I don't know. They were 105 millimetre as against the 25-pounders, but I don't know enough about artillery to know how much better they were than the 25-pounders. But they were self-propelled, and they could move around much more easily. That was the main advantage of them, I think. And I suppose they thought, well, if we're going to stick them on a tank anyway, we may as well put a bigger gun in.
And you were saying about climbing the terrace slope, and about the difficulty of getting up it over the walls. Is there a recognised technique for traversing that sort of obstacle? Could you have used ladders, for example, or some other aids to get over there?
Well, I'd say yes. I mean, if we use ladders for scaling the anti-tank ditch at Merith, I mean, ladders would have been probably very useful things to have. I don't quite know, though, because you would be putting a tremendous amount, a tremendous weight on the ladder at a low trajectory. It wasn't tall enough to be able to put a ladder up like that. So you'd have had the ladder almost flat, probably, and probably it would have collapsed or something.
But a short ladder might have been.
A short ladder might have been.
Handy, mightn't it?
Yes, I mean,
going up 4 foot or so.
It's the sort of thing that I think if anybody had realised what the problem was going to be, they might well have provided us with something like that. I know it's another extra thing to carry, but it wouldn't have been all that heavy, I don't think. But it was a tremendous obstacle to movement, absolutely tremendous.
So you're on the ice, on the way into the beach, I think.
Yes, we've got a. We're on the rice now, and in actual fact, we were on the ship for 5 full days. She was, as I explained earlier, one of the most modern passenger ships on the Dutch East Indies run. So we were very fortunate in having what was basically a very comfortable troop ship. A message from General Montgomery was read out during the early part of the voyage, it started, the time has now come to carry the war into Italy and into the continent of Europe. The Italian overseas empire has been exterminated. We will now deal with the home country. And the message ended, good luck and good hunting. So this is the PR still continuing. Now, having got on to the rice, we laid on 3-hour briefing sessions for each company in the battalion in turn. There was PT before breakfast, which was roundly cursed by most people, but appreciated at a later stage. The Rice, of course, although she wasn't an American ship, was officially dry. But there were one or two bottles floating around if people knew which direction to go in, but not very many. Every day the position of the convoy was marked on the naval map so we could see how we were progressing. It also showed the location of other convoys which were converging towards Malta from North Africa, North African ports rather, Malta and the United Kingdom. There was more training in the technique of getting from the Rice to the landing craft. In other words, we had to learn by heart, as it were, assembling on the correct deck, moving by the correct route to the embarkation point, embarking in the LCA or the LCI, whatever, by daylight and by night. In other words, we had to perfect the technique so that we could literally find our way blindfold as soon as we were told to move to our loading point. And we got that to a pretty good state, in actual fact.
So this was a series of drills, was it?
Yes, this went on more or less all the time until we were absolutely perfect at it. Now, we got through now to the last day at sea, bearing in mind we'd been at sea for 5 days. This was July the 9th. And to the surprise of the forecasters, the weather took a turn for the worse. It was something that they had not expected, and they were absolutely shattered by it. The wind freshened, and by midday on this last day at sea, there was a very rough sea running. It wasn't having much effect on the big ships, but the LCTs and the LCIs were dropping back, and it was quite clear that they would be late at what was called their release position. There was, I believe, a certain amount of discussion at divisional level as to whether a recommendation should be made that the whole thing should be cancelled, but that was of course absolutely out of the question at that time. There was no turning back. We were committed, and whether we liked it or not, and however bad the weather, we got to go in. There was a point of view that said the enemy wouldn't believe that anybody would be so daft as to try and invade in such weather. And in fact, this was, to a very large extent, the case around the coast, where the Italians just didn't think anybody would try it, and they weren't particularly on the lookout as much as they should have been.
Similar thing seems to have happened on D-Day.
Yes, it could be.
6th of June 1944.
Yeah, but this weather was quite unexpected. Nobody expected it. when I soon after, during the day, the Malta and the North African base convoys RV'd with the ships from port side with 5 and 50 divs, and it really was a quite incredible sight. You've got this vast array of shipping as far as the eye could see, most of them with barrage balloons flying over them. And there were literally hundreds of ships of all shapes and sizes, They were ahead of the rice, they were behind us, they were on either quarter. And it was really a huge invasion armada, which I think must have been seen as the dress rehearsal for D-Day. I don't think the Oran landings were, Dieppe certainly wasn't, and I think Sicily must have given them a tremendous amount of information that they could act on before D-Day was planned. The naval liaison officer, we had a naval liaison officer with the 8th Battalion, and there was a trio of LCIs pitching and rolling like small rowing boats some little distance away from the rice. And he's looked over and he said, "They're yours for the show. They only crossed the Atlantic a few weeks ago." And this was so, they'd only come from America and their crews were absolutely brand new to anything like this. I mean, the Atlantic hadn't been as bad as the swell was on that particular day. And out beyond the LCIs, we could see the tank landing craft, tankers, motor transport ships, flak ships. Now, I don't know whether this famous ship, the Roberts, was anywhere near us, but this was an American flak ship.